Hello and welcome back to the Library Cafe after our long summer hiatus. The Library Cafe is a weekly program of discussion about research, books, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. You may have taken a personality type test sometime in your working life. Such tests today are a multi-billion dollar industry. Recently, however, they've come under criticism as being inaccurate and misleading for both the people taking them and the organizations giving them. Human differences, however, are real, and the more we know about how our psychology works and the psychology of others, the better our lives can go. My guest on the program today has shown how our different psychologies actually work, our own inner technology, as it were, so that we can live with skill, psychologically speaking, and relate to others with sensitivity in all our relationships. So I'm very pleased to have as my guest on the program today Sally Kyle. Sally is a Vassar alumna and a Jungian psychological counselor and a professional writer, and she's here to talk with us about Carl Jung's personality theory and her most recent book, To Live in the World as Ourselves, Self-Discovery and Better Relationships Through Jung's Typology, published by Four Directions Press and just released in a new revised edition in paperback in 2017. Welcome, Sally.
Thank you.
Before we go on to talk about Carl Jung and your book, because you are a Vassar graduate, I thought it might be interesting just to talk about your career a bit. You started out here as a French major?
Right, French and religion, mm-hmm. and then I discovered art history. Uh-huh. My high school didn't have it, and it was just amazing to me, the beauty and the history, and art history just pulled everything together, and so I became an art history minor, which went with my French major very well. Uh-huh. And of course, then I specialized in the 19th century. I went on to graduate school, and you know, the novel and all of the ideas that were circulating around in the 19th century, they were proto-psychology. I mean, you look at Balzac or Stendhal or uh-huh. Dickens, you have psychology, they're writing about psychological characters. And you go into art history, and then you have, I mean, I learned mythology mm-hmm. through art history. I finally took a course in it, which was extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. But art pictured all of these archetypes. So when I discovered Jung later on, I already had a background, uh-huh. and I could visualize these archetypes, which Jung thought, and I certainly have observed it now, we walk around with them inside mm-hmm. us. Uh-huh. And in fact, his whole model of typology, he called it typology, please, let's find another word. Uh-huh. They're the four functions of human psychological functioning. They're really archetypal capacities that everyone has as a human being.
So you were a religion minor, I suppose. That
I was.
Also.
So, I suppose so.
So who did you work with?
John Glass.
And in art?
Well, at that time, of course, Linda Nochlin was there, oh, and she was writing on realism, uh-huh. so that was my passion.
Oh, 19th century, yes.
Yeah. Mm. And
she had so much influence over so many people when I talked to them about who was at Vassar in those years.
She was awesome.
Yeah.
Definitely. Leela Barber was uh-huh. still there, uh-huh. and Christine Havelock.
Uh-huh. I knew Christine well. Yeah.
Yes. Richard Palmer, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I took a wonderful course in Frank Lloyd Wright from him. Of course, everyone was Mr. and Miss then.
Oh.
So I never knew anyone's first name, which is just as it should have been back then. Now everyone's first name basis, but we were not.
I kind of miss those days. So you graduated from Vassar, and then I noticed in the year you graduated, John Lindsay gave the commencement address.
Oh, I know.
I don't know if that had any bearing on the fact that you went to work for John Lindsay after you graduated.
Well,
Or were you the reason he came to give the commencement address?
Well, he was married to a Vassar graduate.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mary Lindsay went to Vassar.
Uh-huh.
So that was how I'm sure we were able to get him for our graduation. Mm. But I think he got the biggest kick out of watching us all walk across the stage. He just was sitting there grinning.
Yeah.
But
well, he was something. He was a sort of Republican JFK, I remember, in those
he
years.
Was, and
he
was, and he, you know,
individual.
I graduated, I'll be honest, in 1968, mm-hmm. which was just, you know, the fur was flying everywhere, and he got hit day one with a strike, and we graduated into that world. Mm-hmm. Anyone graduating in the late 60s and early 70s went out into a world that was changing, and it was in full upheaval. It's really very familiar.
Yeah.
Vassar educated us so beautifully, but there wasn't the pressure in society, in the culture, or in the economy to pick a field and go into it and have a career in mind while you were having your liberal arts education.
Yeah, I remember that. In my case, I was at a state institution, and it had been a normal school, became a state university. Mm-hmm. So it was a teaching college, and one time it would have been mostly women planning to be school teachers. But it was more than 50% men when I started because of the draft deferment. Mm-hmm. So, kids like myself, working class kids, had decided to go to college. I'd have gone anyway, but most of the other young men, at least around me, were in there because they didn't want to have anything to do with the war. And in fact, we were very much anti-war. So they weren't, interestingly, they weren't career-minded at all. Mm. They had no idea of career. And in fact, we used to sit around and wonder, by the time we graduated, we didn't believe there would be any money, let alone, jobs, that we'd be living in some new, utopian paradise.
And a time of upheaval, you get very in the moment.
Yeah.
And you relate to whatever's happening in your own way. It's a very individualistic kind of time.
Yeah.
Well, it's very useful to remember nowadays that one is an individual, which is one of the things that I just love about typology. Mm-hmm. Jung was a real believer in the individual and the necessity of each individual to be him or herself. Mm-hmm. His four-function structure that he observed over the course of 20 years. He wrote a huge tome about it ultimately, but he worked first with couples. This was during an era where psychiatrists were beginning to branch out. They weren't just working with psychotic and troubled, very, very troubled people.
Yeah.
Really intelligent people, most of whom had money, found Freud, found Jung, wanted to talk with these wonderful, brilliant doctors about what was going on in their lives and what was going on in their marriages. Marriage didn't used to be much of a communication unless people were really, really lucky. And so if you were having trouble in your marriage, there wasn't such a thing as a marriage counselor. You had your priest or your minister. So these very interesting people found Jung and Freud, and I mostly know Jung's relationship with them, and he saw how people are different and how they can get along better if they accepted their differences. This is a very interesting way to look at the diversity of human beings because it doesn't have to do with gender.
Yeah.
It has to do with human psychology. Yeah. Every individual has these four functions of thinking, feeling, intuition, and sensation. Everyone. So that if you know them, if you know what they are, you know what they are in yourself, you can say, oh, that person perceives with his sensation function. Okay, I'll talk about the fabric of his jacket. It helps you orient yourself to each other. It gets out of the realm of politics. If you want to talk politics, fine.
Yeah.
But you're really talking individual to individual.
Yeah, that's interesting that you frame it as a way of recognizing diversity. In a sense, of course, diversity is the big word on campus now and in the culture general. It's a sort of zeitgeist. It means for us that our differences are something that we need to acknowledge and be mindful of, that we do have differences, and that they should also be something we celebrate. And usually we're talking about tensions that arise, social tensions, political tensions, racial tensions, because of ethnic difference and ideological differences that we have. And diversity then is a sort of core value on a campus or in an intellectual environment, because the more you can harness various points of view into a conversation, whatever comes out of that conversation, the stronger the ideas will be. So, it's something we value on campus. But here, we're not talking about racial or ethnic or ideological difference, but about another kind of difference that often goes overlooked. So, it seems to me what makes your book exciting here is that you're adding really something really substantial to our understanding of diversity and how we can use this understanding to relate to each other, ideally with less friction and more creativity. So your book's very much a part of and adds significantly to this sort of spirit of the time, it seems to me.
How about that?
Yeah.
That's why I have a chapter in my book called Relationships.
Uh-huh.
Because, oh my goodness, you can pretty much guarantee that the person sitting next to you uses a different function from you. You can almost guarantee it. And changing the subject just slightly, there are different ways to look at psychology. There's the approach of taking a hypothesis and designing a study and designing a test, getting results, compare them to your hypothesis, publish them. This is what PhD psychologists like to do. It's an academic approach. Mm-hmm. It's logical. It takes a lot of thinking function, good thinking function, analytic, to do that, very analytic. The thinking function takes something and breaks it down into its component parts and differentiates and compares this with that and organizes. And we all have a thinking function, thank heavens. Yeah. Not everybody uses it the way it can be used, because it takes a little time, and we're in a very fast-paced culture right now. It's hard to process either with thinking or feeling, going at cyber speeds. Mm-hmm. It really is. But coming back, there's another way of looking at psychology, which is what I really like, which is looking at insights that help you understand yourself. Self-understanding, with this universal pattern of functioning, you understand yourself and you can start using your first two functions as you were born to use them. Jung believed that thinking, feeling, sensation, and intuition, those four functions, how they are in your own personality and your own psychological hierarchy, it is natural for you. It's not that you don't have all four, and it's not that you can't use them, and it's not that you can't develop each one, but you do have this hierarchy. And human beings are made to live together and cooperate and work together. And if you have a good sensation function, please, you know, take care of the material aspects of things. Organize the office so that nobody bumps into chairs. And a person who uses his or her sensation function to perceive the world, they see in detail the material world. And sensation function is at your fingertips. It's what you see, it's your senses, what you feel with your hands. Sensation people are hands-on, and the world needs them. And then the other perception function is intuition.
Which we know well.
Which you and I seem to know quite well, which is we may not see all the material details of our environment.
And we hardly see any at all.
This is true. Possible. Yeah. You know, if you can get both socks matching, you're in good shape because you're thinking about something else. Yeah. The intuition function is constantly scanning a landscape, an inner landscape or an outer landscape, for clues. Yeah. The intuition function is to see patterns and clues of significance. I mean, a sensation type would go into a room and see, okay, there's a chair and it's green and it's on the left and there's a window above it, and then there's a table on the right and it's dark wood. It's, you know, see all the layout and the material aspects of the room. And an intuitive would go in and not notice any of that, but could see that on the table was a half full glass of water, and oh, somebody's been there. Ah, there's lipstick on that glass. It was a woman. Intuition extrapolates from the material world. You know,
and
you're,
it's not necessarily rational, is it? It's something
it's
else.
It's a function of perception. Yes. It isn't judging. Neither sensation or intuition judges. There's no judgment.
You had a nice metaphor from Carl Jung that it's akin to seeing around corners.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very helpful. I mean, it's been helpful to human beings forever. You know, the hunter who's looking at tracks, and he can, or she can extrapolate from that, that there's a certain direction.
You get a sense that something's going to happen. You might not be able to explain why you have this sense. You just know it's going to happen.
Jung said, intuition is wonderful. It's 50% right. But fortunately, we all have a processing function, which is thinking or feeling. And thinking is processing all that data that we're taking in by our intellect. you know, it's objective, it's logical, it organizes everything, it fits it into categories of what we already know. Mm-hmm. When I was in college, we had such a thing as a note topic in history, and there was specific kinds of little pads, and we had to take a note, and then on top, the source and the author, and then we'd take the note, and then we'd have to organize these notes. We'd do an outline, and we have to organize all these little pieces of paper according to our outline. Well, I just did not, I was not able to do that at all. My poor history professor was very disturbed because I had such a hard time with it, because I found out years later, my thinking function is third ranking in my hierarchy, and my main way of processing the information that comes to me is through my feeling function. Now, this is an interesting thing. Feeling processing is very little understood in our culture because most people have to think so much. I mean, I'm not being critical of anyone here. We all, wherever our thinking function is in us, developed as far as it can be. And feeling, it runs rampant in our lives. It's not neglected. It often takes us over, but we don't understand it. And I spend a lot of time trying to understand and explain what the feeling function really is.
So let's back up and apply the thinking function here and wait and categorize, you know, what we're
not
doing.
Not me.
So we've got four functions. Two of them essentially have to do with perception. One is sensation, you know, our five senses, and the other is intuitive. We know something's going on. But that information is sort of raw information. It has to do something with it. So our two other functions are thinking and feeling. Feeling isn't the same as sensation, is it? It's an emotional kind of intelligence that constitutes the feeling function. Is that, am I right there? Is that the way I understand
emotional intelligence. Yeah. There have been several books on that now. I was so delighted to see that a few years ago.
And this is what, it's running rampant, but it's also not understood. And this is what allows us to place value on things, right? Because I remember sitting in Ted Taylor's 17th century poetry class at Columbia in a seminar. He posed a question to us, how do you know one work of literature, one poem is better than another poem?
Oh, wow.
And it really is a conundrum if you go at it logically.
I bet.
Of course, you know, feeling function is what would come into play. But you can't really philosophically say why one poem is better than another poem. And people tried to do it in New Criticism, et cetera, but that had all gone by the board. So
it's true. You kind of can't get to the
end
product
of that. It's a different kind of knowing.
It really is. Yeah. The feeling function, one of these days I'll write a book about it because I've had the privilege of growing up with a feeling type. My sister, one of my sisters, is a person for whom feeling is her first function. Her second function is sensation, but she is feeling all the time.
So,
and I married a man who is feeling all the time.
See, so we have a hierarchy of functions, Jess. So they can be in any order. You can have actually a processing function supersede or be a first function to a sensation function. So,
absolutely.
So the processing first comes before even the thing that's supposed to be processed.
For that person, absolutely. We are made, naturally made, our first two functions. There's a processing function and a perceiving function in everybody. Their go-to functions are going to be a processing function and a perceiving function. Yeah. It can be in either order. Everybody has a main processing function. Everybody has a main perceiving function.
Yes, uh-huh.
And the other two are third and fourth in their hierarchy.
Uh-huh.
So that basically describes what Jung called the psychological type. I barely think about what psychological type a person is because I'm much more interested in what function he or she is using to process information or to perceive. That's what really interests me because that's how they're seeing the world. That's how they're coming to understand the world. When I studied this and learned what my first function and second function and then what my third function and fourth function are, I got a sense of who I was.
Uh-huh.
It's not easy to know who you are. It's not easy to know how you are. You've observed yourself, you kind of know how you are, but when you learn something from the dawn of the psychological age that says, this is how human psychology is configured, and oh, gosh, that's me. You know, I am an introverted, intuitive feeling type. That's me. I really started being able to live in a more sane way because my particular typology is a little bit counter to cultural norms, put it that way. So in order for me to live happily and with the psychic energy that I'm capable of having, I have to introvert, and I have to follow my intuition, and I have to follow my feeling function, what I like and don't like, and so on.
So we have a grid. We have four functions, sensation, intuition, and then we have thinking and feeling, and then they're in a hierarchy, and anyone could be first, second, third, fourth, and depending on what place they're in, it will have a lot to do with what kind of a type you are and how you live in the world.
So true.
And then there's another, it's not really a grid, but there's another binary, introvert, extrovert. These are types that everybody knows what they mean generally.
I know, that's the best known. I don't think people really know the source of introversion, extroversion.
Although they don't think of it much, so unless you get somebody who's really terribly introverted, where you feel like you have to have to intervene because they just, you know, or terribly extroverted, where you just feel like you have to kick them out the door because you can't stand anymore, you know, you don't really tend to think of it, but you are able to actually tell if someone tends to one or the other, right? And there aren't many people that fall right in the middle, are there? You tend to be either one way or the other.
Well, you can be much more versatile than you realize. It seems to be a continuum. And once you understand where you're most comfortable, and that's just observing yourself. I mean, this is a wonderful, almost practice, these four functions in introversion and extroversion. It gives you a way of looking at things, and you start seeing it everywhere.
Would your book help someone determine whether they are introverted or extroverted?
So I understand. I mean, I learned this many years ago from reading Jung and from my mentor, who his name is Robert Johnson, and he's a Jungian analyst and has written a lot of books and just an extraordinary, wonderful man. And he was an introvert, so it was, aha, that's exactly how I feel about things. That's exactly how I seem to have to do it. He lectured a lot, and he used to say, for an introvert, one of the safest places in the world is at a podium. For one thing, you have this big structure between you and the audience, so you feel protected. And the other thing is that you're never interrupted. And I've noticed with introverts, you can see them chin down. Extroverts, their chin is up. Introverts, their chin is down. That's kind of a signal if you're looking around.
Eye contact also.
Either can have eye contact, but it depends on whether they're looking up there or through their eyebrows, the way you are right now. My stepson, Sean, is an introvert, and he found out about it when he was a teenager, which was a wonderful thing. I wish I'd known these things as a teenager. But he said, oh, yes, extroverts talk in order to think. Introverts think in order to talk.
Interesting. You mentioned you found out when he was a teenager, children exhibit these traits early on, don't they? Both the introvert, extrovert, and also the personality type, yes?
Well, they seem to. Yeah. It does seem to be part of our nature.
Yeah.
And it does seem to evidence very, very early. One of my stepchildren is a teacher, and I have a sister who's a teacher, and they both say that they can see introverts and extroverts, and they can see the little thinking types and the little feeling types, you know.
Knowing would help a teacher a lot in terms of managing children in a classroom, knowing, you know, how children are going to respond to attention, how they're going to relate to one another. I would expect this kind of information, especially if you learn how to type people by watching them, it would be very useful just in getting through the day. I mean, I can see it being professionally useful for people who choose juries and that kind of thing. But just for the ordinary person, for your coming to understand how you relate to people at work, which is what your book is about to some extent, is that you have many, many examples of ordinary people that it's hard to know if they're hypothetical people or people. It seems as though they're people.
They're real people. That's an interesting point. You asked me how I did research for this book. And I have really had to think about that because I learned it the way lawyers used to be trained. You know, you work with somebody and they authorize you to do what they did and you just go ahead and do it. I mean, that's what I did.
Clinical training therapy.
Well, it really is. Yeah. It's like a training analysis, they call it now. Yeah. But I think that this kind of information, it's really not necessarily for experts. It is for just anybody who wants to know themselves better and wants to get along with people better, or someone who's putting together teams. And I know that there are tests out there, and a lot of people have taken the tests. My approach is to learn about the functions and what they do, and you can motivate people better if you know what functions they're using. If you have a person who's really very sensation endowed, you know what tasks to give the person, and you know how to motivate the person. If they want 14 different kinds of materials, they should have it, because you're going to get a much better product. And an intuitive, you're not going to have an intuitive packing boxes. It's just, I mean, if you go to the grocery store, every once in a while, my heart just bleeds, because here's this person who's trying, you know, all these things are going through the conveyor belt, and they're just holding it together by their fingernails. It's just hard if you're an intuitive perceiver to deal with a lot of different items. I mean, an intuitive's desk can be really, really, really messy, but they're only concentrating on one little corner of it.
So when we're talking about types of people, you have a tendency not to want to essentialize people in a way. I mean, that's kind of postmodern way of thinking that, especially since even existentialism, that these aren't essences, essentially. They're tendencies we have in the way we behave, right?
They're preferences, maybe. Preferences or natural inclinations.
Yeah, how we're
or
comfortable in doing things.
Natural talents.
Yeah.
I'm telling you.
Yeah. Talents.
They really are. Yeah. They really are.
But they're very there. And, you know, once you start seeing them, I imagine it's helpful. And since I've read your book, I have to say, I understand my place in my workplace much better than I did. I mean, I always have a problem, often with colleagues, where I feel like I'm just not connecting somehow. I'm talking up in some ethereal, you know, level. And they're nuts and bolts. I mean, that's the way I explain it to myself. I think it has to do with the fact that I'm an intuitive perceiver. And I don't know if I'm a thinker or a feeler, but I think probably a feeler.
And third function, you know, if whatever your first function is, you're a intuitive, your second function's going to be a processing function.
Yes.
And your third function's going to be a processing function.
Okay.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. And once you realize this, you can be versatile. There's a lot more versatility. Your third function, you can develop it. The analogy I use is like your ring finger. You know, you can use it, you can develop it, you can make it stronger, but it's never going to be as strong as your second or first finger.
Okay.
It's like that. You can use it. I have third function thinking, for instance. It took me 12 years to write this book. 12 years.
Yeah.
It took me a long, long time to take all the information that I knew. There wasn't much research on it. I had to research it within myself and then organize what I knew. The reason why I wrote the book was that I had taught my family this, like my stepson and my two stepdaughters and my sisters and my husband and friends. That was just natural to talk about who they were and their gifts. And, well, the person's 6'4" and he's very well educated and he's a thinking type and he dresses really well, so he has great sensation function. And it just all fits in with the way you think about a person at one point. And it was so natural the way I learned it. So when I organized it, I looked at the book and I looked at, okay, what did I learn first? What did I see first? Then what did I see second? What did I see third? What was my development in getting to know this body of knowledge, which is arguably the most important body of knowledge I've learned since graduate school?
Well, that's interesting.
I use it all the time.
Yeah. So you do type people then that you meet and the people you know. I mean, you come to understand how they're functioning.
Yeah, I think the other way around.
Yeah.
I come to understand how they're functioning and then maybe I put a word to it.
Oh, I see.
And it is shorthand.
Yeah, and you know if people seem to have a shortcoming in one way that they...
I'll tell you, sometimes people's fourth function is more obvious than their first.
Yeah, the fourth function is an interesting function, so maybe you should
it
talk about it.
It's
the lowest one on the hierarchy, the last one, but it's...
It's the opposite perceiving or processing function from the one you use first. And it's kind of like you're talking about flying analogies. It's like if you're using your first function And this is how your ego consciousness manages the plethora of experience that you're having. Your ego consciousness goes to your first function, and it consults your second function, and less often your third. And the first function, the other perceiving or processing function, is your fourth function. And it's kind of like concentric circles. You know, your first function's very close, and it's your go-to function. Your second function is close-ish. Your third function is there. You know it's there. You don't go there very often. And the fourth function is like Pluto. It's out there, or Eris. It's way out there. You can't get there from here very easily because you're always using your first function. And if you're flying on that wind tank, the other one is switched off. We can't use all our functions at once. We'd be psychotic. You can't. Ego consciousness has to pick what you're doing. You have to be either perceiving or processing something.
Can you give an example of a fourth function? Yeah.
Well, I suppose being intuitive. Well, there are a lot of examples. Yeah. I will say, Jung called the fourth function the God function. And you can use a big G or a little G there. Because it's so far away from ego consciousness, it is, in a way, rogue in your life. It's there, and you have it, and it appears and disappears. One of the most poignant examples of a fourth function is a thinking type who falls in love. A thinking type who falls in love, his or her fourth function is feeling. And their feeling function just comes up like a volcano, and they are gone.
I'm thinking of Fritz Lang's Blue Angel, Marlene Dietrich.
A thinking type who falls in love. Yeah. Absolutely, just obsessed. And the whole rational processing, the ego trying to rationally process, it can't. It's captured. It's just captured. Being intuitive, my fourth function is sensation. Okay, the sensation, the whole material world, the whole natural world is my fourth function. And getting dressed in the morning, I have to go to my closet. And I just have to go into a trance. And, you know, somehow I pick out the right skirt or the right this and right that. And I won't tell you the number of times that I've had to change because it just wasn't right or wasn't appropriate for the occasion or something like that. I mean, just getting dressed in the morning is a challenge. But
cooking then, which is a sense of
cooking. My husband says that I can cook for two people and maybe three. After that, I'll cut myself with a knife. The intuitives I know really don't like knives because your perception function is really a question of attention energy. It's where your attention energy wants to go.
You mentioned that when we were talking about introverts, extroverts, that there were whole peoples that seemed to have a tendency toward one or the other.
I remember doing some business in London once, and there was something, and I just relaxed totally because no one was going to invade my space ever.
Yeah, yeah.
You walk into a tea shop, and maybe somebody glances up.
Yeah.
But you are not going to be aggressed at all.
Yeah. And of course, the cliche is, you know, the British are always saying chin up, but their chins are never up. The British are always down. So.
Oh, that is funny. Yeah. It's true.
Americans, on the other hand, we as a people don't tend to celebrate our introverts particularly, do we? I mean, we have them, you know, people like Thomas Jefferson. But on the whole, people who seem to do well are people who can relate to other people easily.
Extroversion is a huge boon in our culture. There's no question about it. Thank God for them. I mean, I'm always very, very happy if there's an extrovert near me because I can just be quiet. This is bringing up a subject that's very interesting in this general topic, which is that there are norms. They're norms. And when you're looking at your own typology, your own configuration of extroversion and introversion and thinking and feeling processing and intuition perception and sensation perception, you're going to be in different environments in which certain functions are encouraged and rewarded and cultures also. I mean, our culture does reward extroversion. There have now been best-selling books about it and in a way distrusts introversion. even in classrooms, you know, the children who raise their hand, I know, you know, they do better. The teacher thinks they're smarter, whereas a little introvert sitting there going, I know the answer. Mm-hmm. But she or he wouldn't necessarily raise the hand because it just doesn't feel right. Mm-hmm. It may not even matter to the person. Norms can be challenging, mm-hmm. I think, for feeling processors. I was very lucky. I think for particularly first function feeling people, an introverted feeling type in our culture mm-hmm. has a real challenge ahead of him or her. I actually have two in my life now, introverted feeling people. And one is a little girl who comes in from school and goes right to her room. Mm-hmm. And her mother is extroverted. And it's like, oh, okay, I guess I won't find out how your day was. But her mother knows about typology, and she knows who this lovely little girl is, and she lets her be introverted. Yeah. And this little girl has a lot of confidence, uh-huh. a lot of self-confidence, because her mother lets her do it. Yeah. That. Now, this is a wonderful thing for parents yeah. to know, because their child is using functions in a certain way. Parents know it, but they probably don't have a word for it or a model for it.
Yeah. So we have cultural prejudices, I guess, about certain functions, probably.
At least, you know, norms.
Yeah, norms, yeah.
And prejudices in some yeah, people.
And so the question is, do they have gender associations? We mm. seem to have this idea, for instance, that men are rational and sense-informed, mm-hmm. You know, insofar as they tend to be realistic, ideally athletic. And women are intuitive and feeling-oriented, you know, touchy-feely. They don't think much. You know, those are the stereotypes. And certainly intuition and feeling seem often to be given short shrift, both of them, as perceptual and processing functions. Mm-hmm. And am I right about this?
Yeah, I'm sure it's true.
Your book seems, I mean, I read it as a feminist work to some extent, and then you give
did.
So many examples of women in it.
That's interesting.
You know, Cassandra, for one. And,
oh, gosh.
And Pocahontas. I know. Interestingly, you have examples both from history and people you know.
Well, I really think that I've fleshed out my understanding of this whole model through examples. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how I learned it. Ah. You asked about research.
Yeah.
Researched examples. If I saw an example of something, I'd yeah. make a note, you know, and I'd just try to describe it. Yeah. Because what I like to think, it's living information. Mm-hmm. This is living information. It's not just something you know. This is information that lives.
Yeah.
And so you're constantly seeing examples of it, and you're constantly learning more about it.
Well, we did mention, after you left Vassar, you have a graduate background in comparative literature as well as social work. Literature is very much about this, it seems to me a natural kind of meld.
It's true.
I mean, you use literary examples a lot in the book.
Yeah, I guess I do. I mean, I love examples. My background professionally early on was not just writing, but in journalism. So, you know, journalism, you get a phenomenon and you get an assignment and you go out and look for examples and you describe them, and then your article is about the phenomenon with
yes.
examples.
Yes, yeah.
And so when I
trying to make it concrete.
Wanted to explain what this model was, I decided to do it from examples because that seemed the best way to do it, and there's sure a lot of them out there.
Yeah. In your previous very wonderful book, it's taken from interviews. It's a book about the Women's Air Service pilots in mm-hmm. World War II, and it's basically kind of oral history.
It is oral history,
yeah.
I know, because when I did my research here again, yeah. there wasn't anything written about it.
Mm-hmm.
There were recently declassified top secret reports of the program, because of course during World War II there couldn't be knowledge that women were flying airplanes.
And this was a very substantial corps of women that flew.
Yeah, they just got the Congressional Gold Medal a couple of years ago.
Warplanes, including B-17s and B-29s, out to the theaters. So.
They did a lot of test piloting. They did target towing. The men had to be in the war theaters.
Yes. Yeah.
So the women did a lot of the domestic flying.
And your aunt
were done
was,
by. Yeah, my aunt was a B-17 pilot, so I know.
That's great.
I was lucky.
So anyway, it seems to inform the way you've done this book, too, to some extent. It's very much an in-the-world book, it seems to me. It's not just theory. You've got so many examples, and they're so apprehensible and available.
I'm glad to hear it.
It's really a way of coming to know these types and how to read them.
Well, I really hoped that anyone reading the book, because a lot of people will come to this completely new.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll go about it the same way. You see, my dream someday, I really think, I mean, this is talk about fantasy, but I think this sort of information is the most wonderful seminar in a high school or college, and it does not exist. As far as I know, I have never heard of one seminar in this, but if I had been 18, 19, 20, yeah, and
had taught you Carl Jung.
Well, yes. Not just Jung, just this.
Yes.
I mean, Jung is going to come into it.
Yeah.
Jung is extremely complicated. Yeah. When I distilled the way I learned about this, it was like a seminar. The first thing I learned was about extroversion and introversion. That's the first thing I perceived about it.
Uh-huh.
And when I learned that concept, for the next 2 weeks, I was looking everywhere.
Yeah.
I was saying, oh, that person is introverting. Look, that person's extroverting. Look. You know, it was like you learn a concept, and then you go out and you observe. And then the next thing I learned was the four functions. And then the next thing I learned was that there were two functions that perceive the world and two functions to process the world. And so I distinguished between perceiving and processing, taking in information and making sense of it. Then I looked at the function order, the hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
What is the function that is most prominent to ego consciousness?
Mm-hmm.
That person, the minute you meet him, he's talking about the book he's reading, he's talking about politics, and he's analyzing the speech last night, and you just get to say, all right, that person is a first function thinking person. And then you know what kinds of information to exchange with the person, and you don't gush and say, oh, I just love that politician, because the thinking type will just freeze, because it's too fourth function for him or her.
Interesting.
So that's kind of how I learned it. And then I realized how the information is used in relationships, how people do get along or don't get along, and why you don't get along with somebody, why you never got along with your brother very well, and how you can get along. I mean, my mother and I discovered that she and I were both intuitive perceivers, and from then on, we had what I call intuitive's delight.
Uh-huh.
We could just follow our intuition functions and just follow them, you know, intuition scans. I mean, you can always tell an intuitive because you'll just watch their eyes. They're scanning, 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 scanning. You know, they're scanning you up and down, and they're looking for clues.
So birds of a feather here can get on very well, right? But opposites can get on also, right? As a married couple, you don't have to be the same type as your partner to have a happy marriage, do you?
In fact, this is what Jung first perceived, was that an introvert and an extrovert very often pair up.
Uh-huh.
And it's...
They complement one another.
They complement one another. And this is... I love this about this whole model. It's really about working together.
Yeah.
I'm not really that good at this. Here, if you don't mind, I can do a little bit, but if you don't mind, you're chopping the carrots.
Yeah.
Or if you can figure out a function that you can always find common ground, always, because you have four and they have four, and even if they don't know it, if you're really aware of your own functions and you know what they do, you can always connect with somebody and you can always encourage them.
So in the contemporary world, because of technology, we tend to be deprived of direct sensation as everything around us is virtual. We stare at screens all day, maybe eating a Snickers bar at the same time. Is this a problem, do you think? And would it place people who privilege sensation in the society as first function in a difficult position?
This is the challenge, again, of knowing your typology and making sure that you're fulfilling it. I think of there are two endangered functions right now.
Uh-huh.
The aspects of contemporary life, there's a lot of discourse now about the effect of the machine age, that we're tethered to these little robots in our hands, and that people are walking down the streets in Manhattan and it's a miracle they don't bump into one another because they're looking at the screens. If you look at that image, there are two functions that aren't being used. One is sensation.
Certainly.
Your body is just going totally on autopilot.
Yes,
and people don't run into each other, but I think they also do. And the whole sensation realm of the body is restricted to this tiny little screen.
And one thing we should say with sensation types and with sensation generally, it's not just visual sensation.
Mm-hmm.
Sensation types will be able to smell things, they'll be able to taste things, they like to feel things, right?
Absolutely. I mean, a sensation type takes in data with their entire bodies.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
There's a thing called proprioception, in which your whole body is taking in information from within and from without. And that's a meditation in itself. I mean, meditation, in a way, is stopping processing and just perceiving.
That's very interesting.
And sensation perception is a wonderful way to meditate. Mm-hmm. Even if you're a sensation type, just slow down. You're so good in your environment. Just slow down and just pay attention to all of the different senses that you're picking up. Yeah. I mean, that is endangered.
Yeah. So.
The other thing that's happening if you're just looking at a screen all the time is that you're not relating to another human being in the flesh. You know, the feeling function is how our psychology processes intelligently our organism. It's millions of years of DNA development. It is all of our biochemistry. Our feeling function understands our biochemistry, and it can work with it intelligently. And the trouble with having an endangered function that isn't being paid attention to is that it goes into the unconscious. It goes into the lower levels of the psyche, and it goes rogue. Uh-huh. It really does. I mean, that's why in the really smart folks out in Silicon Valley, they're taking their kids' computers away.
Oh,
they want their children to relate to the environment, to one another. In our time, it was probably too much television, but now it's exponentially important to make the conscious choice to practice your sensation function, to go there and to get to know your feeling function. Because I think as a counselor, the state of our relationships is really pretty dire. You know how you use this kind of information in psychotherapy. You know the suffering of not knowing which of your functions are really you naturally and trying to use one that isn't your nature. It's not that you can't use it. It's just that I know a feeling processor who just graduated from Harvard Law School, but he took a year off. He worked with children. He knows that his way of learning is through people. And if you're a Vassar student and you're a feeling processor, get a mentor. Really take advantage of your way of learning in relationship. And pay attention to all four functions. You know, colleges are a very thinking environment, and professors are very thinking. It's the model of higher education, and it's a fantastic thing, and that's their heritage and the role of academe to protect the thinking realm. The challenge comes when you're a thinking professor and an expert, and you've got a feeling processor in your class, and all I can say is have fun, because you've got somebody out there who learns in relationship. Have fun with the person. You know, allow the relationship to happen.
I wonder how these spread over the disciplines. Do thinking processors tend to go into STEM classes, math, and of course, and sciences,
philosophy,
whereas
and history.
Types will go for history and literature, you know. So
I'm sure that's true.
Although, ideally, we're exercising all of our functions. And
ideally.
So a couple questions. One, can a person possibly learn, or are there exercises one can do to learn how to understand what type of person you might be dealing with or what type you are? First question. Second question, can you exercise various functions that you feel might need some work?
Oh, I'm sure all of the above.
Yeah.
Being an introvert, I like asking questions. But the art of question asking is a really good way to research what a person is. And, like, take a film. Okay, bunch of friends go to a film. Thinking processors and feeling processors. The thinking processors will start analyzing the plot, and it's like this other film, and there's a little difference, and, you know, might be able to describe the various developments of the characters and so on. And the feeling processor is sitting there going, oh, I just hated that guy. I just hated him. He was horrible, you know? Or you can say, oh, I just love that movie. Oh, I don't know why. Oh, I just loved it. It made me feel so good. You know, so if you grok a little feeling processor, you say, well, how did you like that? Or for a thinking person, you can say, well, what is your opinion of that film? You know, you can ask the question in a certain way that brings out, at least it allows the person to express who they really are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you may not really care. It might bore you to tears, but at least they'll really appreciate it.
Yeah.
I tend to think that information like this, Tom, is so, oh, there's so much in it. There's so much to it.
Yeah. Well, the book is an attempt to raise consciousness, in a sense, isn't it?
Oh, I would love that.
Yeah, yeah.
I would love that. Yeah. And everyone has a learning, what would you say, a modus operandi of learning. Mm-hmm. So many people, you know, read the chapter on extroversion and introversion, and that's good for them for a year because it's so big and it's so profound. Yeah. If you really start to understand it, it's, when do you extrovert? When do you introvert?
Yeah.
How can I extrovert? How can I best introvert?
I was just on a search committee, and we had various candidates coming in, and I had just read that chapter, actually, of your book before the interview started. And I have to say, most of my perception of what went on in those interviews had to do with introversion and extroversion.
Library science is, what do you think? I mean, library science.
You mean librarians? How do we tend to go?
Yeah,
it's hard to
say.
We had two candidates in. One was obviously an introvert and a thinking processor. We had a phone interview. And, you know, we'd ask a question and 30 seconds, 45 seconds would go by before we got an answer. And, you know, I wondered, did she have her hand over the phone? She's asking, you know, our best friend what, you know, what the answer might be. No. When she arrived for the interview, we realized she's a thinking processor. She thought about that question she was asking, wanted to give a very precise, rational answer. She was very much like that. Whereas we had, you know, another colleague came in who said, I'm an extrovert, you know, and it was obvious she was, and it helped me to understand where she was coming from.
That's
interesting. You're right, these things, though. You see them in the world when you start to look for them, surely. So.
Oh, it's true. And really, the difference between thinking and feeling. Once you realize there is a difference, and
how
once
you... not be irritated with people? If a problem comes up and the person isn't, doesn't seem to be approaching the problem rationally, they seem to be, you know, just sort of feeling their way through the problem. It helps you understand that we do have differences.
Last question, and, you know, as long as we're back here at your alma mater, and obviously you're a very wise person with a lifetime of experience behind you.
And ahead.
And somebody spent a good part of your professional life steering people through their problems and giving advice. Do you have any advice for students?
There's so many questions when you're a student. Yeah. Oh, my goodness, you're kind of following your nose in a way, but you're also, you've got relationships going that are very, very intense, very intense. Yeah. And I'm a feeling processor, so I tend to communicate with people in terms of their relationships. I think that it's very important while you're going through a really good education like at Vassar to remember there are four functions. Remember that you're in 4 years or 5 years a very, very intense education time. And don't forget your sensation function. Mm. Don't forget your feeling function. Mm-hmm. Enjoy. Go into the library. Pick up subject and find a book. Then look at the book next to it and look at the bibliography or the footnotes, and that'll lead you to something else. I mean, follow your intuition that way. It's so much fun. It'll lead you to really interesting things. You will be trained to think analytically, and that's a wonderful thing, and you will never, never regret it. But don't forget that there are four functions, and the feeling function in particular, it goes into the extracurricular realm. The feeling function learns in relationship, but it is a very finely tuned and wonderful function that everybody has to pick up subtle cues in yourself and to pay attention to situations that you're drawn to and situations that you want to hold back from, and pay attention to those things as well as, you know, writing your papers and so on. And maybe even you'll find professors who will allow you to follow your intuition or allow you to pick a paper because you really like that subject. That's how I picked my papers.
So the word is the word we started out with, diversity here, isn't it?
Wow.
Value diversity, even in the kinds of subjects you study and the way you approach those subjects in terms of the way you process information. So I'd like to thank you, Sally, for visiting with us on the Library Cafe today to talk about your book, To Live in the World as Ourselves, Self-Discovery and Better Relationships Through Jung's Typology.
Published by Four Directions Press and just released in a new revised edition in paperback in 2017.